But I want to thank you that no one is here by accident this morning. That you have something to say, something to give to each one of us. Thank you that you're a God who speaks. You're a God who always wants to bless and encourage, to comfort us, to strengthen us. And you know how each of us feel this morning, whether we come bowed down by stuff, or whether we come full of the joys of spring, or whether we come just in the middle of those things. You know us so intimately. Sometimes that's a scary thought, Lord, but thank you that it's also a really comforting thought that there's someone who knows us so well and yet loves us completely unconditionally. We thank you for that this morning. We thank you for bringing Christine to us, and we ask now that as she comes to speak, you will give her the strength that she needs, and that as she brings your word to us, that you will bless her, that you will pour in as she pours herself out, and that she will be surprised by the blessing that she receives just by being your channel and your servant this morning. Lord, we're so grateful to you for women of God like her who can come and share with us so that we can become more the people that you want us to be. So we ask that we'd have ears to listen to you this morning. Lord, whatever else is going on in our minds, help us just to put that to one side and to be able to listen as Christine speaks and to listen to you. And we ask it in your name. Amen. Do sit down and we'll swap.
Come down there.
What is it about the front row?
You're back on. You should be back on now.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Hello. Great. Well, it's... got the stool there just in case. Yeah. Try not to faint on you all. In fact, I said to Heather when I sort of emailed her, talked for her earlier in the week, I said, really sorry, Heather. I've got to tell you that I'm just a little bit touch and go whether I'm going to make it. She said to me, Christine, I seem to remember you were ill last year as well, she said. Didn't you come with laryngitis? And I said, actually quite a healthy person usually. But anyway, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me back. And I think, as I've said to you often before, a couple of times before, I do love these women's things because I just think it's great when God gets his women together. It's very special. It's very sweet. And I just think there's a releasing and a leveling and a sense of, yeah, we just know where each other is at. And I think particularly in this day and age when so often, you know, we sort of feel a whole equality thing, you know, we've got to sort of compete and be strong. Actually, isn't it great when we can just say, yes, I can embrace my femininity. I can celebrate. We can celebrate together our womanhood, that fact that God has made us who we are for a reason. That there are differences between us and men. And actually, yeah, some profound ones. I picked this up the other day. Profound differences between men and women about things like money. A man will pay £2 for a £1 item he needs. A woman will pay £1 for a £2 item that she doesn't need, but it's on sale. Bathrooms. I'm not sure whether this one's true, but anyway. A man has 6 items in his bathroom: toothbrush, toothpaste, shaving cream, razor, a bar of soap, and a towel. The average number of items in the typical woman's bathroom is 137. A man would not be able to identify more than 20 of these. Arguments. A woman has the last word in any argument. Anything a man says after that is the beginning of a new argument. Dressing up. A woman will dress up to go shopping, water the plants, empty the bins, answer the phone, read a book, and get the post. A man will dress up for weddings and funerals. Looks. I think this one's a bit unfair. Men wake up as good-looking as they went to bed. Women somehow deteriorate during the night. And children. A woman knows all about her children. She knows about dentist appointments and romances, best friends, favourite foods, secret fears, hopes and dreams. A man is vaguely aware of some short people living in the house. And the last one, haircuts. A woman's conversation with a friend about a haircut usually goes something like this. Heather, you've just had your hair. I can see it. They've sort of shaped it up the back a little bit differently, haven't they? And I love the way it just sort of comes up towards your ears. Really nice. And you've had a little bit done to your fringe too. Oh, and I love the colour. Really nice. A man's conversation with a friend about a haircut. Haircut? Yeah. Profound differences between men and women. And we're going to celebrate being women together this morning. And as Heather said, I'm going to turn us to the book of Proverbs today. I've been reading it over this last sort of year, really. I've tried to pick up on something I heard that Billy Graham did all his life, or a lot of his life. He apparently read one psalm, one proverb, and his daily reading every day. And I think that's because Proverbs just has these extraordinary little encapsulates in one verse sort of something extraordinary and profound and significant about just ordinary everyday life. And it just has that way of just digging deeper and of just raising our standards about how we respond, how we react, how we live our everyday lives. So I found it fascinating. Proverbs has been called the most down-to-earth book in the Bible. Derek Kidner said, Proverbs is a book which seldom takes you to church, but it puts godliness into working clothes. And Bill Hybels adds this, it puts pertinent truths for everyday life on the bottom shelf where we all can reach it. It takes the ageless, priceless wisdom of God and makes it understandable and accessible to people like you and me. It's poetic, yet practical. It's humorous, yet helpful. It's direct, yet deep. Where else, he says, can we find the wisdom of God compressed into a few pithy phrases that please our ears, stretch our minds, and satisfy our souls? Great stuff. Now, I don't know how well you know the book of Proverbs, but just let me give you a flavour of some of my most favourite pithy phrases from Proverbs. Like these. Chapter 11, verse 22. Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman who shows no discretion. Chapter 16, verse 31. Grey hair is a crown of splendour. It is attained by a righteous life. Just looking around at a few of us. Chapter 21, verse 9. Better to live on a corner of a roof than share a house with a quarrelsome wife. Chapter 22, verse 31. Do not gaze at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a snake and poisons like a viper. Your eyes will see strange sights and your mind imagine confusing things. You will be like one sleeping on the high seas, lying on top of the rigging. Isn't that fantastic? Chapter 27, verse 15. A quarrelsome wife, another one about women, wives. A quarrelsome wife is like a constant dripping on a rainy day. We all know that one, don't we? Well, Proverbs is one of the three, what are called wisdom books in the Old Testament. The other two are Job and Ecclesiastes, and they tend to deal with the questions such as how or why. Big questions such as, you know, how do you explain the meaning of life? Why does suffering happen to good people? Whereas Proverbs tends to deal with the questions that begin with what. You know, what are the qualities of a good wife? What are the dangers of casual relationships or of drinking too much? What would this person be like to employ or to work for? What would this person be like to live with or to live next to? Proverbs deals with totally practical, everyday, ordinary dilemmas of life. Proverbs, if you like, puts up a mirror to our character and lifestyle and says to us, are you like this? Well, think about it. there may just be a better way to live. And it's essentially a guide on how to live wisely. Now, not necessarily worldly wise, but godly wise. How to live wisely. And we're going to start our day, as Heather said, by looking at what advice Proverbs can give us on how to use words wisely. Now, I've got some handouts here. Why don't we get those out to people? A few handouts just to keep you with me. I always find, I don't know about you, I always find it helpful to sort of know where you're going with things. But words don't always come easily to us, do they? Just take these examples of some genuine, and these are all genuine answers from teenagers in recent GCSE exams, okay? Genuine answers. Question. Explain the processes by which water can be made safe to drink. Answer. Now, this is a genuine answer from a teenager in recent years. Flirtation makes water safe to drink because it removes large pollutants like grit, sand, dead sheep, and canoeists. Question. What guarantees may a mortgage company insist on? Answer. If you're buying a house, they will insist you are well endowed. Question. What happens to a boy when he reaches puberty? He says goodbye to his boyhood and looks forward to adultery. Okay, what about this one? Question. What happens to your body when you age? When you get old, so do your bowels and you get intercontinental. Last two. What is a terminal illness? Answer. When you are sick at the airport. And our very last one, question. In a democratic society, how important are elections? Listen, very important. Sex can only happen when a male gets an election. Genuine answers, I promised you, from GCSE exams. Anyway, words. Aesop, of Aesop's Fables, was asked what was the most powerful thing in the world. The tongue, he replied. And what is the most harmful thing in the world? The tongue, he replied once more. Our tongue takes up less than 0.045% of our body weight. But it's the greatest asset we have and the most potentially destructive possession we own. And this morning, we're going to think of the different kinds of words we use. And you can see from your notes, we're going to be just picking out verses from all over the book of Proverbs. But I'm going to just start us off by reading some verses from chapter 18. And as I read them, I just want you to note the ones that tell us, the ones that pinpoint, tell us about the power and the use or misuse of words. So, where's my Bible? Chapter 18, just to get us sort of focused in. If any of you have got a Bible, do turn to it, but otherwise just listen to this. So just for yourself, pick out as I read through anything that tells us about the power of words. A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing his own opinions. When wickedness comes, so does contempt, and with shame comes disgrace. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters, and the fountain of wisdom is a bubbling brook. It's not good to be partial to the wicked or to deprive the innocent of justice. A fool's lips bring him strife, and his mouth invites a beating. A fool's mouth is his undoing, and his lips are a snare to his soul. The words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to a man's inmost parts. One who is slack in his work is brother to one who destroys. The name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to it and are safe. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city. They imagine it an unscalable wall. Before his downfall, a man's heart is proud. But humility comes before honor. He who answers before listening, that is his folly and his shame. A man's spirit sustains him in sickness, but a crushed spirit, who can bear? The heart of the discerning acquires knowledge. The ears of the wise seek it out. And then just jumping down to verse 20 and 21. From the fruit of his mouth, a man's stomach is filled. With the harvest from his lips, he is satisfied. The tongue has the power of life and death. The tongue has the power of life and death. You can see this is serious stuff. You know, God's intention is that our words should be used to give life. You know, to give wisdom to each other, to give depth and understanding, to give sympathy, to give discernment. And the author of the Proverbs minces no words when he talks about the person who uses words wrongly. And here in this chapter, did you notice, he's called a fool. Elsewhere in Proverbs, he's also called a scoundrel, a villain. His mouth, we're told here in verse 6, invites a beating. His lips, we're told, verse 7, are like a snare, a trap to people. His words are shameful, verse 3. They're disgraceful, verse 11. You know, this is the depth to which we fall when we use words wrongly. Conversely, we're told how wise words have the power to speak life and health and healing into each other. Chapter 18, in verse 4 of our passage, the words of a man's mouth are deep waters. Doesn't that conjure up a wonderful picture? Chapter 16, verse 24, another wonderful picture. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul, healing to the bones. And in chapter 15, we're told the tongue brings healing, that brings healing is a tree of life. Wonderful pictures, aren't they? Now, many of us are very adept at using words. You know, we've had a lifetime to get to, you know, to practice. And they may have been a very vital part of our profession, you know, if we've been a lawyer or a teacher or a counselor. But the lessons of Proverbs are not just how to use words skillfully or cleverly, but how to use them wisely and profoundly and with integrity. But let's look, first of all, at what happens when we misuse words, when we maybe use words falsely. I wonder if you remember a moment when you were betrayed or lied to. A time maybe when you were hurt by a confidence being broken or the truth being twisted, putting you in a bad light. Now, I expect you remember some of those experiences in vivid details because we don't forget easily things like that. I wonder what was your reaction at the time? Did you want to sort of withdraw, just hide yourself away, let the moment pass? Did you want to rant and rail at what had been said about you? Maybe what had been said against you? Did you feel violated? Did you feel let down? Did you wonder if you would ever trust in the same way again? Now, these are some of the effects of words being used wrongly or carelessly. Chapter 15, verse 4 says, "A deceitful tongue crushes the spirit." That's the power of words. But Proverbs 12 says, "The Lord detests, he hates lying lips." Now, seldom does the Bible use stronger language than this to describe God's response to sinful behavior. God detests, he hates lying. And I think it's because God knew that without a radical commitment to telling the truth, marriages and family life would disintegrate. Friendships would be destroyed, business dealings would fall apart, churches would be split by division, and governments would become ineffective. The very fabric of relationships and society would unravel. Now, it's easy for us, isn't it, sitting here in this lovely church today, to think to ourselves, well, you know, actually, that's fine, but I am not, I promise you, I'm not a compulsive liar. You know, this is not my problem. But we've got to realize that this command is actually far-reaching. And it actually does affect each one of us. It doesn't just refer to perjury in court or libel in newspapers or deceitfulness among politicians. It's the gossip over coffee or in the wine bar. It's the false reassurances over the phone. It's the broken promises. It's the exaggerated stories. It's the covering of our tracks. It's the passing on of a rumour. That's what it embraces. That's how far-reaching it is. Now, I wonder, you know, do you ever possibly exaggerate the truth? Do you possibly ever just tell a story and add just a little bit extra to make it sound better? You know, maybe describing a personal accomplishment or even more, one of your children's accomplishments. And you just, you know, it just manages to sort of grow into slightly more inflated terms. Have you ever twisted the truth to allow someone else just to take the edge of the blame? Have you ever got yourself into a hole and then felt tempted just to tell a little fib just to get yourself out of it? You know, it's interesting, isn't it, how often we use that word fib instead of lie. It sort of lets us off the hook, doesn't it? It allows us to take things just a little less seriously. You know, we almost make a joke of it. It was only a little fib. But lying is serious to God, and it should be uncomfortable to us. These two quotes uncover an uncomfortable truth about lying. Abraham Lincoln said, "No man has a good enough memory to be a successful liar." Mark Twain said, "If you always tell the truth, you never have to remember anything." You can never leave lies behind. You know, they follow you. They follow you, don't they, down the track. I wonder if you remember how you felt the last time you said something that wasn't quite true. You know, a little queasiness in your stomach, a little heat on the back of your neck. Because lying is a messy business. We weren't created to lie. We were created in the image of a truth-telling God. And lying will and should make us feel bad about ourselves. Now, I'm not going to ask you to expose yourselves, your latest misdemeanors, but I'm going to just, you know, come clean with a recent incident that I'm not so proud of. And it happened just last year. And yes, it's very clear in my memory. Three women going skiing on the same week, but to different resorts. My sister Annette, myself, and a close friend of mine called Lulu. I didn't have any ski trousers, so I went to my sister, who has everything, and she kindly lent me some. They were bright yellow, which, you know, was a bit of a shame. Not my favourite colour, but beggars can't be choosers, so I said thank you and I took them home. And then two things happened just before going on holiday. I found some really nice black ski trousers in TK Maxx. Knockdown price. I thought, okay, yes, I'm going to invest in these. And then my good friend Lulu rang me and said, "Christine, I'm going skiing for the first time. I just wondered if you had any ski trousers I could borrow." And I said, "Yes, Lulu, I've got some lovely yellow ones. They'd be perfect. I think, you know, they'd be great." That's where it began. I offered something that wasn't mine to give. And unfortunately for me, on their way back from holiday, Lulu and Annette happened to meet at the airport, and they know each other. And Lulu, bless her, quite innocently said to her, "Do you know, your lovely sister Christine lent me some great yellow trousers. You know, they were a little bit bright, you know, a little bit on the bright side. I could be seen all over the mountain, but, you know, wasn't, you know, they were just what I needed." My dear sister didn't give me away, but when she got home, she phoned me, and we had a little conversation, and she said, "So, Chris, how was your holiday?" "Oh, lovely, had great time." "And ski trousers okay?" Yeah, they were great, thank you so much. Yes, they were fine. So they fitted all right, did they?" "Yes, yep, they fitted well. And they were warm enough?" Yes, "I expect you could be seen all over the mountain in them, couldn't you, Chris?" Yes, that's right." You know, and it just grew and grew. And then she said to me, "Funny thing, Chris, I bumped into Lulu." And I just felt this hole opening up in front of me. It didn't look good. You know, I'm the vicar's wife. It didn't feel good. But, you know, the moment we stop feeling deeply uncomfortable as we tell untruths, at that moment we're in trouble. And for so many, the line between truth and lies has become blurred and even disappeared altogether. Bette Midler, the American actress, recently confessed, "I never know how much of what I say is true anymore." It was meant as a joke, but it's an awful truth, isn't it? How easily our conscience is dulled when we don't take this seriously, when we just allow our standards to slip. So that's false words. But how about simply careless words? Proverbs gives us some refreshingly honest observations, some wonderfully practical hints on how we can learn to use our mouth. And the first bit of advice it gives is very straightforward. It says this: if you want to sin less with your words, then talk less. And it's serious. If you want to sin less, then talk less. Proverbs 10, verse 19. When words are many, sin is not absent. But he who holds the tongue is wise. So simple. But it's so hard for so many of us, isn't it? Proverbs 15, 28 adds more. The heart of the righteous weighs its answers, but the mouth of the wicked gushes evil. Now, I wonder, will we be women who are careful with our words, who will let, or will we be careless? Will we let, you know, whatever we're thinking simply spew, gush out of our mouth? Simply because it's there in our heads, we let it out of our mouths. The wisdom of Proverbs tells us that we don't have to participate in every conversation. We don't have to give our opinion in every situation. We don't have to express every thought that comes into our mind. Isn't that interesting? Verse 2 of our passage says, "A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing his own opinions." Now, how many thoughtless, hurtful words might be silenced if we took less delight in the sound of our own voice? Chapter 13, verse 3, "He who guards his lips guards his life, but he who speaks rashly will come to ruin." And chapter 12, "Reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing." Now, did you notice the strength of those words? Reckless, rash. You know, those are strong words, aren't they? But does that describe some of our conversations, if we're honest? Words pierce like a sword, we're told. They so often have a far deeper thrust than we realize. And one of the hard lessons about words wrongly spoken is that they're irretrievable. You know, once said, we can't take them back. And words so easily, don't they? They just slip off our tongue. We don't think in those unguarded moments. And we can be so careless if we're honest. And also, if we're honest, we can also rather enjoy letting loose with our tongue, just allowing it to have that sort of freedom. A little bit of gossip can be rather delicious. Proverbs 18, verse 8. Did you notice that verse I read out? "The words of a gossip are like choice morsels. They go down to a man's inmost parts." Now, just imagine, I think this is what it's trying to get us to imagine. Imagine a plate of delicious canapés or petit fours, you know. They're all just perfect size to take in a mouthful. And they're so tasty. They go down in one bite and they just whet our appetite for more. And gossip is the same. It's so tempting. So bite-sized, and it's so delicious. Anne Roosevelt was heard to say, "If you can't say something good about someone, come and sit here by me." Gossip is when you hear something you like about someone you don't. But gossip ruins friendships. It wrecks communities, and it destroys personalities. And I wonder if we can determine to be women of God who refuse to give or receive gossip. Not even if it's passed on simply so we can pray about it. Chapter 26, verse 20 says, "Without wood, a fire goes out. Without gossip, a quarrel dies down." Chapter 11, verse 13, "A gossip betrays a confidence, but a trustworthy man is able to keep a secret. I came across this little acrostic the other day with the word think. 5 questions to ask yourself before you say something. T, is it true? H, is it helpful? I, is it inspiring? N, is it necessary? And lastly, K, is it kind? A simple but effective guide to using words wisely, to think before we speak. Because we don't want to be women who use words carelessly, do we? We want to use words truthfully. We want to use words well. Like clouds and wind without rain is a man who boasts of gifts he does not give. Proverbs 25, verse 14. We need to beware of the casual promises. I'll call you. I'd love to help. You must come to dinner sometime. Just send me your CV. You know, I wonder if there's even one of us who hasn't been hurt by people who've broken their promise to us. And we've probably let people down in the same way. But you know, there's another side to telling the truth, and it's one that Bill Hybels calls trading truth for tranquility. And this is about being prepared to say the more difficult things, the hard things to each other. Now, where do we find ourselves then? At that point, do we find ourselves hesitating, holding back? I have a friend who's destroying herself and her family through bitterness and self-deception. But she's a strong personality, and I find it almost impossible to face her with what she's doing. Now, why am I afraid to speak the truth? What's wrong with me? I can see it, but I won't say it. I have another friend who came to Christ a number of years ago, but recently she's chosen a different path. She's now caught up in quite a sort of heady, materialistic lifestyle. Her husband is almost definitely an alcoholic, and I again find it almost impossible to challenge her on it. Now, what's the matter with me? I have a member of my family who's a devout churchgoer. You know, if there's a worthy project going on in her community, she's there. Right at the center. She's a person who lives her life desperately and passionately doing good deeds, but who I know doesn't have assurance of her salvation. Now, why don't I tell her? Why do I stay silent? And the fact is, I shrink back from telling the truth because it might cost me something. It might make the relationship uncomfortable. I might be misunderstood or rejected. Or put down. God forbid that my friends should tell me that it's none of my business, or that I should stay out of their family life, or that I'm just an overzealous Christian. And the ugly truth about me is that too often I choose peacekeeping over truth-telling. I fail to say things that need to be said because basically I'm thinking of my own comfort. And I need to be reminded of Proverbs 3, verse 3. Let kindness and truth never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Do you notice? 2 words to hold on to there. Not just one. Truth and kindness. They go together. And it's this unique combination of truth mixed with kindness that makes the difference. One without the other can be disastrous. You know, those who go around speaking the truth without love, they simply brutalize others. You know, they force truth into people's lives insensitively. They just leave a trail of hurt, of confusion in their wake. But those who overflow with kindness and never get to adding any difficult truths to those soft words, they hold no real substance. They love everyone. They want everyone to love them. They want the world to be a happy place. But they simply leave a trail of sentimentality. You know, there's no strength. There's no depth to their words. And this passage offers the antidote to both brutality on the one hand and sentimentality on the other. Proverbs compares wise words with a piece of fine jewelry. says this: a word aptly spoken is like apples of gold in settings of silver. Like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise man's rebuke to a listening ear. Wise words, you know, said at the right time and in the right way, are absolutely priceless. But, of course, they take skill, they take great skill to deliver. Now, I wonder, are we ready to work at that? Are we prepared to develop those sort of skills in our lives? Can we be women who speak words of great price into people's lives? I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? What impact might that have? Do we have friends like that? Friends who do that for us, friends who we're accountable to, friends who are brave enough to speak into our lives? Or can we be such a friend to others? Could we dare to do that? Because when we find people who hold those two qualities together, friends who are able to speak into our lives with truthful words that pierce any immaturity in us, any lack of understanding, that uncover our self-deception or our wrong attitudes, but don't crush our spirit, those are friends who are worth holding on to, aren't they? They're the friends who are worth sticking close to. Do we have friends like that? Can we be such a friend to others? And I'm going to talk a bit more about that this afternoon. But I won't forget, years back, one friend of mine challenging me kindly but firmly about my perfectionist, rather controlling spirit. And I remember her words as if it was yesterday. She said to me, "Christine, your standards are very high, and you make things hard for yourself, but more importantly, you make it hard for other people around you. You don't give space for people to grow." That was the gist of what she said to me. And I can't say that was easy for me to hear, but it was exactly what I needed to hear. And you can tell that was said to me about 10 years ago, and it stayed with me. It stayed with me because it was important for me to hear. And she was a brave lady to say it to me. But she'd earned her right because she was a friend who knew me well and who loved me well. Now, I don't doubt that here today, many of us, if not all of us, have been maybe deeply hurt by things said to us that have been said wrongly, at the wrong time, in the wrong way, in the wrong place. Or maybe we've deeply regretted things we've said to others. And again, we have come out of a wrong place. But God has an answer to the things that can't be put right, the words that can't be brought back, the things we've said to others, the things that maybe have been said to us. And that answer is forgiveness. And that's what I'm going to end with here this morning, because the only way forward sometimes is giving or receiving forgiveness. Forgiveness is said to be love's toughest work and greatest risk. And the issue of forgiveness touches us every day. Every day. Sometimes it's deep-seated things that we've carried with us over many years. It might be rejection or abuse or injustice of some sort. But, you know, much more often it's smaller offences. You know, it's a friend who doesn't return your phone call. It's a colleague who puts you down or talks about you behind your back. It's a group of friends who forget to include you in their plans. All these things hurt us, don't they? And they need dealing with. And forgiveness isn't just a sort of healthy exercise. It's life-giving. It allows us to move on with life. It allows us to live life to the full. Proverbs 14:30 says, a heart at peace gives life to the body. And chapter 15, verse 4 says, the tongue that brings healing is a tree of life. And as Christians, we all know that forgiveness is vitally important. But, you know, often there's a disconnection between our understanding of forgiveness and our ability or inability, if we're honest, to grant it to others. C.S. Lewis points out, forgiveness is a beautiful word until you're seeking to forgive. On a lighter note, a conversation was overheard in a wine bar. "You know me, Angela, I'm not one to bear a grudge. even against people who've done things to me I could never forgive. Forgiveness often involves a crisis of the will. It's not so much about the heart, it's about the will. Am I willing to forgive? And to do that, we have to be clear in our minds what forgiveness is and what it isn't. Forgiveness is not about excusing the actions done against us. Let's get that right. Forgiveness is the opposite of excusing. The very fact that forgiveness is needed shows that what happened was wrong, you know, and in a sense without excuse. Forgiveness is not about simply forgetting, you know, which is actually quite a passive sort of process. It's not about waiting for a memory to fade with the passage of time. Forgiving is an active process, not a passive one. Forgiveness is not a feeling. It's an act of the will. You know, we very rarely start from a position of feeling forgiveness for a person who's wronged us. We simply need to do it because we know it's right. It's right and healthy for us, and it's right and good for them. Now, there are two particular people in my life that I've had to work really hard at to forgive. The first one was my father. We were very close. I loved my dad to bits. But he remarried without telling me, and then he died a year later in a car crash. And it's unknown whether it was through negligence or a deliberate act. Secondly, the other person who I found it very hard to forgive was the doctor who failed to diagnose our daughter Emily's skin cancer when she was just 9 months old. And he even insisted at the time that we were, well, he implied we were making a bit of a fuss and we certainly didn't need a second opinion. With the first, with my dear dad, I know that I've done the work of forgiveness that has been needed to allow me to move on. It took me a while, but now my memories of him are clear and vivid and special. And it's not that I'm ignorant of his failings, of how he let me down, but they don't spoil my memories of him anymore. I've done that work. With the second, it was actually only a short while ago that I realized I still hadn't let go of the blame, even after 25 years. Our daughter now is 28 years old. It was when our daughter, Emily, phoned me. She phoned me very excited, and she said, "Mum, guess what? I've just met a girl today, same age as me, who had exactly the same type of tumour as I did. She had it on her arm. They caught it early, and, you know, there's only a small sort of little line scar left, from it. Isn't that amazing?" And as she spoke, I felt my heart tighten. And in my mind, I was thinking, through gritted teeth, "Yes, that's great. But if your doctor hadn't been so incompetent and proud and left things so long, you too would have been left with a fine line scar. And if he could answer to me now for that enormous hole they had to gouge out of your back because of his misdiagnosis, you know," and my thoughts just went rampant. And I was shocked at how angry I still felt. I thought I had dealt with it. I thought it had been done. And when I put down the phone with her, I had to get back down on my knees and I had to ask God yet again to help me get it right, to help me not let it fester and grow and make my heart hard. Now, in the New Testament, the Greek word for forgiveness means simply to let go, to send away. And at the heart of the action of forgiveness is decision to let go. There's nothing passive about experiencing forgiveness. It's not sort of some mysterious formula that suddenly eradicates our problems, you know, changes our behavior, removes the past. Forgiveness is a powerful thing, but it requires action on our part. And so here as I close, I'm going to give you six A's on how to forgive well, how to do the work of forgiveness. Firstly, address everyone involved personally, if you can, if it's right. Don't try doing it over the phone or by letter, and certainly not by email. Someone once said, the reason for asking forgiveness is to erase the past, not document it. So the rule is, if possible, always ask forgiveness face to face. That's the ideal. Secondly, avoid the words if, but, and maybe. The best way to ruin a good confession is to use words that shift the blame or try and minimize or excuse your guilt. And that little word but is especially harmful because it has this strange ability to cancel all the words that precede it. You know, let me give you an example. Listen to these confessions. I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, but you really upset me. I know I was wrong, but you were being so difficult. I didn't mean to, but you were so impatient. Do you see? Do you see how it just nullifies anything that went before? We need to strike these little words from our vocabulary when saying sorry. We also need to watch, and I think this is particularly true of us women, the tone of our voice. We have a joke in our family, it's against me, that I have a particular way of saying I'm sorry, which sounds more like, well, I'm sorry, which basically means you're going to be sorry. But it's not good. Avoid the words if, but, and maybe, and watch the tone of our voice. Thirdly, admit specifically. Try and admit specifically. Take responsibility for specific actions, not sort of just a general admission that things aren't right between you. A small thing that often helps this process, you know, is to deal with attitudes as well as actions. So to admit, you know, your pride or your selfishness or your insensitivity. Do you see? To admit where your wrong action has come from. Fourthly, acknowledge. Acknowledge their feelings. Acknowledge their hurt. The most effective apologies show that you're trying to understand how the other person felt as a result of your words and actions. Not concentrating on your own feelings. It's not for you, it's for their sake. So try to put yourselves in their shoes. Acknowledge how they must have felt. And it may sound something like this. You know, you must have been terribly embarrassed when I said those things in front of everyone. I'm so sorry I did that to you. Or I can see why you were so frustrated that I made us so late. I'm so sorry I didn't get back on time. Do you see? We just are getting behind the reasons why things happened. Fifthly, accept the consequences. Sometimes it's good to show that you're willing, you're ready to accept the consequences of your actions, rather than just trying to get out of things, you know, with a quick apology, you know, I'm so sorry, and moving on. And of course, we see this done beautifully in both the parables of the prodigal son, when he returns home and says to his father, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. You know, make me a slave, make me a servant in your household. That's all I deserve now. And the story of Zacchaeus, when he offers to repay everyone he has cheated. Lovely sign of being ready to accept the consequences. And number six, allow time. When you ask for forgiveness, be careful not to use it as a means to pressurize someone into making a decision he or she isn't ready to make. And we need to remember with this that some things need a longer time, depending on the amount that needs to be forgiven. Forgiveness is a decision we make. We need to decide to forgive. That's our part. God's part is to change our feelings, to make us feel that forgiveness. And Corrie ten Boom illustrates this with a story. I don't know if you've read this one. She illustrates it with a lovely story of how she was plagued for years with memories of an atrocity committed against her while she was in a concentration camp. And she'd forgiven her offender, but years later, she said, the memories were still giving her sleepless nights. So she went to her minister, who drew her attention to the church tower just outside their window. And he said this to her. In that tower, Corrie, is a bell, which is rung by pulling a rope. But, you know, even after you've let go of that rope, the bell keeps on swinging for a while, First ding, then dong, then slower and slower, until finally there's a final dong and it stops. And he said, I believe the same thing is true of forgiveness. When we forgive, we make that decision to take our hand off the rope, to stop pulling it anymore. But if we've been tugging at our grievances for a long time, we mustn't be surprised if the old angry thoughts keep coming for a while. You know, they're just like the ding-dongs of the old bell slowing down. And that's how it works with many of us. The dongs that continue to sound in our minds long after maybe the offences have happened against us may or may not completely stop, but they will become less frequent and less intense. How? By making sure we take our hand off the rope. And no one is saying that's easy to do, particularly if things have been done to us that have been really hard, gone really deep. It's a hard thing to let go of the rope when we've been used to tugging it again and again. And we may have to remind ourselves again and again to take our hands off and let that old bell gradually slow down. That's the work of forgiveness in us and through us. And of course, we know it's at the heart. It's at the heart of our gospel. It's the heart of who God is. And that's why it's such an important, such a key thing for us to both understand and put into action in our everyday lives. So shall we stand? Shall we do a little bit of business? Because I wonder if there's some of us here who recognize we need to let go of the rope. We need to take our hands off. And maybe it's something that was done to us long time ago. Maybe words that have been said to us. Maybe things that have been done to us. And maybe they're still very vivid in our mind, in our imagining. But God wants to break the hold of those hard things over us for our own sakes and for the sake of those around us. This work of forgiveness is an absolutely vital one. So I'd just like to invite us here. There are some of us here who know that we need, even maybe after many years of trying, this is a moment again, a moment that God is giving us when he says, come on, let me help you. Let me help you take your hand off the rope. No more tugging, no more pulling, no more jogging the memory, no more going down that road. Let's take your hand off the rope. And he says,